I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The January 6th committee meets again this afternoon, continuing its investigation into the attack on the U.S. Capitol to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election, including the role former President Trump played in fomenting the riot. Some of the committee's key public witnesses worked in the Trump White House or for the Trump campaign, and their testimony has been damning. Now, a majority of the Republican members of Congress have either ignored or minimized the committee's findings or accused it of conducting a witch hunt. Our guest Tim Miller has some thoughts about the lies and conspiracy theories that sparked the January 6th insurrection. His new book, Why We Did It, is about GOP operatives like himself who played the game, winning no matter the cost. Miller has left the party and doesn't hold back on criticizing himself, admitting to the shame and guilt he feels about poisoning our politics. He joins us on Radio Times to discuss his book, his political coming out, his coming out as a gay man, and the state of our political system. Tim Miller is now a political analyst and journalist at The Bulwark, got up real early to join us on Radio Times. Tim Miller, nice to have you with us on the show.
Hey, happy to do it. Coming in live from Oakland, California. There's a lot there in that intro.
There sure is. You gave us a lot to talk about, and I really appreciate that. Let's start at the beginning. Let's start with young Tim Miller. He's a teenager. What was your attraction to the GOP?
Yeah, I grew up in suburban Colorado. She wasn't far from Columbine High School, which is also ends up being influential in my career arc and professional arc. But I thought that the GOP was a party of free markets and free people, the party that would help. Excuse me for the cliche, but sure. People pull themselves up from their bootstraps, that would promote economic growth, that was, that believed that America was a force for good in the world, that we were, as Reagan said, a shining city on a hill, that would welcome, people from all over the world who came from, more oppressive systems of government. That kind of optimistic, pro-growth, pro-freedom message from the GOP is, I think, what initially drew me to the party. I was always more of a moderate Republican, and I think that, as we'll talk about, as I got into politics, I ended up, being attracted more to the game and the sportsmanship of it, to the winning versus the losing, the fighting. But initially, everyone gets in politics for earnest intent at some point, and that was what drew it to me as a young Republican in the suburbs.
How do you think being closeted, which you were really until your adulthood, how do you think that shaped your politics or even how you played the game of politics?
I think it definitely did. For starters, I think that when I came out of the closet, it in a lot of ways, it saved me. It expanded my capacity for empathy. I think that the closet is really hard. Everything that you do is a lie. The clothes you wear is a lie. The way you talk sometimes is a lie. And so you get used to, dealing with these, internal confusions and bitternesses and grievances, and they kind of manifest in strange ways. And for me, it manifested in just this deep comfort with, kind of public relations and, subterfuge. And I think that probably had I come out earlier and more integrated, all of the parts of myself, I think maybe I would have seen, the cruelty and what I came to be turned off by the Republican Party earlier. And I have regrets about that.
Well, and you write very honestly, I have to say, about your regrets about that. But you also talk about this super ability, in a way, to compartmentalize. I mean, I think we all do that to some level, but I'm assuming being closeted, you have to really compartmentalize your life. But also, as you say, to be an operative and to play the political game, you have to be very good at compartmentalizing.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure, there are a lot of things you compartmentalize in your life. Even after I slowly came out of the closet, I still was in the closet to, my family and to some people in my life. So, yeah, you're really living two different lives. In the political game, absolutely. Look, I write about a story in 2008. I was working for John McCain in Iowa. John McCain slips in an interview with Chris Matthews. Some listeners might remember this, and says that he's okay, if gays, you know, have a private ceremony type of thing, you know, to honor their marriage. This was when gay marriage was still illegal. And, you know, this becomes a controversy, and McCain has to walk it back. And I remember working for him at the time, and you would think, as a closeted person who was, you know, could only dream of the fact that I might be able to be married one day, which I am now, it's the most important part of my life, we have a child together, that this would have been exciting for me. But instead, I was angry at him because I wanted to win so badly. And I was like, you can't win in Iowa in a Republican primary being for gay marriage in 2008. This was such a mistake. And so I just think that shows how warped, you know, the mind can be. And I wrote about this because in the hopes that it would be telling as we got further along in the book as to how people who knew better went along and justified Trump. Like, if I could compartmentalize this element of my life that's so important, that's so central to who I am and my joy, and just put it away in a little box in my brain and focus instead on the, you know, competition of politics, then think about how easy it is for people to compartmentalize, you know, things that don't affect them personally, you know, that might only hypothetically affect others. And so I really wanted to explore that deeply and kind of understand. You know, I went back and looked at all my old emails and texts, like, how did I do, and all my old interviews that I did about this, how did I do this? How did I compartmentalize this and try to explain it to folks?
Well, even after John McCain, you worked for Ken Cuccinelli, who was, you know, who said homophobic things. Was it still that mindset for you, which was about sort of putting your gay identity, your gay life in a box and focusing on winning?
Yeah. I mean, it became harder and harder. As time went on to do that, it was, you know, the reality of this tension would eke out of the box more often. But yeah, look, I remember I tell the story of being in a debate prep with Ken Cuccinelli, and other people in the room don't know I'm gay. At this point, I was out of the closet, but some of my colleagues knew, others didn't. And, you know, they go on this homophobic rant during debate prep. And I'm sitting in the back of the room, kind of my palms are sweating, like going, what am I doing? Like, why am I here? I don't like this person. This is a hateful person. But at the time, I was a political consultant, and he was our client. And our company actually was just growing and wasn't doing that well. And so in that case, it wasn't about competition, but it was about career. You know, I was like, for my company to survive, I need to take on this client. He's noxious, but I'm going to do it, and I'm just going to compartmentalize it and put it in a box and not think about it, not worry about my integrity. This was all nonsense, by the way. I mean, you know, I could have taken another job. Sure. I had a lot of options. I was privileged, but this is what you tell yourself. And so, you know, over time, I wanted to draw a parallel to, you know, as I got to the Trump era, I interviewed a lot of my friends, and I asked, why did you stay? Why did you keep working in Republican politics? You know this guy is dangerous. You know he's bigoted. And they would give the same answer I basically gave for Cuccinelli, right? Which is, well, my career, our company, we need to... And so, you know, for me, this was kind of a hard reality because I wanted to wag my finger at them and judge them and say, how could you go along with this awfulness? But I had to first look at myself and say, well, how did I go along with Ken Cuccinelli? I mean, is there a difference between a governor's race in Virginia and the presidency? I guess, you know, you could draw a line. But still, a lot of my rationalizations were the same.
You went into therapy.
It makes you feel bad to revisit all this.
No, I know we're dragging you through.
It's one thing sitting in your bed in a room and writing about it.
Yeah, of course.
You know, talking about it is, you know, is mortifying. But it's important, I think.
Well, I think it's important because, again, you know, none of us are perfect here. But I think you have an ability to help us understand the kind of mindset. As you say, a lot of people... Talking about former President Trump, a lot of people saw him for who he was, but were willing to work for him for some of the same reasons that you just described.
Yeah. These were the critical people. You know, and this is what I wanted to focus on in the book. Look, there are some that went along with Donald Trump because they were ideologically with him or because they liked the cruelty. Or because they, you know, had, you know, sociopathic, you know, psychological issues. But those people were necessary but not sufficient for him to gain power and stay in power and do all the things that he did all the way up until January 6th. He needed the, you know, as Bill Stepien testified in the January 6th hearings, you know, he thought he was on team normal.
Yeah.
While he was silently going along, you know, with this coup that would have ended our democracy. He needed all these people on team normal, you know, in order for his political project, Trump's political project, to work. And so at some point back, you know, before I left the party, I was on that team normal, and so these were all my friends and colleagues, and so I wanted to kind of explore the psychology of this, and hopefully, you know, if the book really succeeds, you know, pokes holes in these very comforting stories that they're telling themselves, where in their social circles, it is true that they're like the good ones. We're on team. We're not the crazy ones like Rudy Giuliani and you know, Sidney Powell and the Kraken lady and the MyPillow guy. Like, we're the normal ones. But that's a lie. Like, they're telling themselves a comforting lie. Like, they are part and parcel of all of the dangerous things that we've all watched and experienced. And so I'm trying to, you know, bring some light to that and hopefully shake a few of them loose.
Well, you start, this is your first second sentence, the introduction to your book. America never would have gotten into this mess if it weren't for me and my friends. We were the normal Republicans, the pragmatic and practical, the adults in the room you hear so much about. And I think it's easy to get distracted by the, you know, the MyPillow guy, but you're saying you were the ones in the trenches making this happen.
Yeah, and we worked with the, you know, more extreme members of the party. This is, you know, the Mitch McConnell wing, you know, what used to be the Paul Ryan wing, the Mitt Romneys. You know, we thought, those of us in the so-called establishment, that, like, we were in control of the party, right? And that we had bumpers, you know, on the bowling lane if things got too far out of hand. We'd throw the base some red meat from time to time. And this remains, despite all the evidence against it, the conventional wisdom among Republicans in the consulting class in Washington, D.C. And yet the truth is that it is us, the supposed, it's not me anymore, but these folks, the supposedly adults in the room, they are getting drug along by the Steve Bannons, by the Breitbart wing, by you know, Trump and his conspiracy mongering. And they are being brought along with them, not the other way around. And they are being drugged to the extremes. And you know, there's just this news story yesterday. Herschel Walker,
yeah,
who's running in the Georgia Senate, is a prime example of this. Completely unqualified, conspiracy-minded, you know, believes the election was a hoax, climate change a hoax, all of this. I read this news story in Politico yesterday. Mitt Romney's former communications director, who I worked for, you know, she is now taking a job to help Herschel because his campaign is floundering, and try to you know, put a nicer sheen on this person that is obviously unqualified by a far stretch to be a senator. It's the same story happening over and over again. You know, people that think they're trying to nudge the crazy in the right direction are actually getting pulled along, you know, by the extremists and the conspiracists.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Tim Miller. He's currently a political analyst and journalist for The Bulwark. He's got a brand new book, Why We Did It, a travelogue from the Republican road to hell. And he was a Republican operative, a stalwart, as someone described him. He's now a never-Trumper. You can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Tim Miller. He was a political attack dog for the GOP, reveled in taking down opponents at just about any cost. He has since left the GOP, become an outspoken critic of Donald Trump, and he's got a brand new book. It's called Why We Did It. Tim, let me get back to, and you've referenced this several times, but you go into great detail about what you call the game. In a sense, people like you, who are the operatives, were the, as you described, kind of the drug dealers. The GOP was the addict. So you were feeding them, what, Oppo research, so that they could, they, either members of the party or the party itself, could be victorious in the game of politics. Help us understand how this game works.
Yeah, and there are a lot of elements to it, right? Obviously, there's the television advertising, the annoying emails and text messages that you get, you know, the direct mail that you throw away, right? But and the main part that I worked in was dealing with the media, but all of this stuff works together, and when you get in the heat of politics, I think the most corrupting element of politics that I see now with more clarity, you know, having left it, is the rush, the adrenaline, the competition of being inside a political campaign. Oftentimes, like, the whole point of politics, which is to elect someone who is going to do the best job of governing, you know, to help, you know, your fellow citizens, that gets totally lost, right? It's like that becomes something that not only do you not think about, but it's almost mocked, you know, when you bring up, you know, like, what impact is this going to have on people in a strategy meeting? Like, the question is, what impact is this going to have to help us win or lose? And so, you know, just some examples from my communications experience.
Sure.
I worked a lot with the far right media types, right? And I would feed them, you know, little bits of opposition research, little bits of negative information about Democrats or about, you know, the other the candidates that I was working against. And I was once complimented by this other conservative media, you know, heavyweight, who, and I look back on this and cringe. He said, you know, Tim, you're so good at this. You know, you can stick a knife in somebody with your tongue in your cheek, right? Like, you know, there would be hyperbole or, you know, a little bit of puckishness, you know, and, you know, gamesmanship. But the problem was the voters who were getting this information, you know, via all these methods, the negative attack ads, you know, their social media feeds, the news that they're seeing, they're not in on this game. Like, they're not in on the joke. And a lot of them were getting radicalized. I mean, just look at, you know, if you look at Hillary as a prime example, I mean, just the hatred and the vitriol that Republican voters had towards Hillary. I mean, there were legitimate reasons to you know, maybe disagree with her on policies or not love what, you know, they did in you know, trading access for power or whatever, but you know, to just loathe someone, that comes from years and years of them just being fed this rage juice, this negative information. And we did it day in, day out, and it didn't matter, you know, whether we were exaggerating or gilding the lily. Like, that was just part of the job.
Well, let me quote you again. You write, rather than trying to address their underlying concerns or channel their anger for good, these would be Republican voters, which frankly voters. May or may not have been possible. We chose instead to try to manage a raging fire, redirecting their resentment toward cheap culture war calories. And I underscored the word calories. I mean, and we can see the culture wars being played out even as we speak.
Oh, yeah, we're obese on culture wars now, to extend the metaphor.
Public health crisis, yes.
Yeah, exactly. You go back, and I think about the ones from my time. I mean, obviously, there's so many we could talk about now. You know, the stuff that hits closest to home for me is obviously what's happening in the schools with the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida and, you know, sports and transgender youth. I mean, none of this stuff is a core concern for voters. You know, there are legitimate things to be concerned about right now, gas prices and you know, I look back to the 2010s when I was working in Republican politics. There was good reason, I think, for working class voters to be upset about how their communities had been hollowed out, how they had, you know, suffered the consequences from these wars, you know, that we had got us into. But rather than, you know, try to change the Republican policies to, like, meet those concerns, we were feeding them nonsense, like, oh, be upset about the Ground Zero mosque, or, you know, be upset about the caravan that's coming across the border. You know, there was a conspiracy back in the late 2000s about the NAFTA superhighway that was going to bring Mexicans up into, you know, Iowa and New Hampshire that you would hear about from these voters. You know, like, none of that was real. It was all just a way to tickle the anger that was inside of these people and redirect it towards the Democrats or towards elites or towards immigrants. And over time, it shouldn't have been surprising that bubbled over, right? And that they said, okay, well, we want to go with somebody who is more capable of channeling our rage. This guy, Donald Trump, the carnival barker, you know, the person who will tell us what we want to hear. You know, we don't want these kind of effete Republicans, you know, with their briefcases, you know, trying to, you know, pretend like they are in touch with our anger. But we were the ones that made them angry in the first place. It was like this doom loop.
Well, let me go back, because you did work for John McCain, and you write about Sarah Palin, and you say something that, I've been thinking about as well, which is obviously he chose her for vice president. He actually wanted Joe Lieberman, but he was convinced that, she would be the person to take his campaign over the finish line. But I wonder whether picking her, she was unqualified. She would lie. She would say incendiary things like Obama was palling around with terrorists, and she was able to fire up the base. Do you think that set the stage for Donald Trump?
In some ways. But I think that it's important to understand this is a bottom-up issue. I write about how, so I worked for John McCain in the primary, so before he picked Palin, I write about how I went to these events in Iowa, and the anger in this crowd. You know, at the time he was working with Ted Kennedy on a reasonable immigration reform bill, but, you know, they considered that amnesty, and, they were mad about immigrants in Iowa. It's not as if immigrants were taking their jobs in Iowa in any meaningful way, but he was getting lambasted, and, you would hear from, you know, these voters just vile things. And so, you know, when he picked Sarah Palin, it was, I think, this manifestation of we need somebody that can kind of touch you know, the emotions of our own voters. And the Palin rallies were, these precursors to Trump rallies, you know, with, they were feral almost compared to, you know, the more staid McCain events. And so, you know, in some ways it was a precursor for sure, but I think it was a sign that this is what voters, you know, kind of wanted, and that we were headed down this path, you know, one way or another. But it was on us for stoking it. And I think, you know, basically losing control of the fire.
And again, Tim Miller, our guest today on Radio Times. He's now a political analyst and journalist at The Bulwark. He's got a brand new book. It's titled Why We Did It, subtitled Travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell. And he was a Republican operative, did a lot of oppo research, worked for a number of candidates and members of a Republican Party, and left the party, is a never-Trumper, and joining us to talk about his book. And again, you can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I see Beverly writes something about reading your book and finding it kind of depressing. And it was a question I have for you, Tim, because I felt the same way. And I am not naive about politics. I mean, I've, you know, I lived through the 60s, and so I understand what's at stake here, but there is something so dispiriting to sort of understand what's happening behind the scenes. And as you write, a lot of people, for instance, that worked for Trump, but like yourself, voted for Hillary. I mean, the kind of cynicism, I think, that's at play is quite worrisome.
Yeah, it's not an uplifting or a hopeful book.
No.
I'm sorry to report.
We'll get to that, but yes.
I did my best to include some comedy throughout it. It's a dark humor, but,
and I'm not criticizing you. And I mean, I think it's important to understand, but it's the cynicism there.
I appreciate that. I mean, there's a deep cynicism in the Republican political class. And I wanted to write the most honest book I could. You know, the nice thing about being homeless politically now, you know, that I voted for Hillary and Biden, so I guess I'm not homeless, but the nice thing about kind of being out of the political game is that I can be fully honest. I'm not angling for another job, or, you know, I'm not thinking about my future career. I just wanted to explain to people what it's like. And so, and the truth is just dark, you know, within Republican politics right now. You know, I tried to lighten it with some humorous flourishes to you know, make people not, you know, start reaching for the, you know, rope while they're reading the book. But it is true. And you know, these books are usually end, my publisher said, they usually end with, like, you know, some kind of recommendation or an uplifting element. But we're in the middle of all this still. And so I didn't want to it almost felt trite to try to do that. And so instead I end the book with this conversation I had with this old friend of mine, a person who is also a moderate Republican, Caroline Wren. She got wrapped up in Trump world. She finds herself on the permit for the January 6th rally. She had been a moderate. She had flown to Germany to help refugees. I knew this person. She had a very soft side, a big heart. And I didn't understand it. How did she go along with Trump where I didn't? And so we went and had drinks together for hours and hours on end. And you know, basically the story unfortunately ends. I felt like I came so close to breaking her a few times. Mm-hmm. But all of these rationalizations, you know, are so powerful for why she's stuck with him, that I just couldn't do it. We got right up to the ledge a few times and couldn't do it. And, you know, the book kind of ends with us walking down the boulevard in Santa Monica and kind of dealing with the reality that we're just separate. We're going down separate roads, and she's still on this Republican road to hell. And I wanted to leave the book there because that's where we are, right? I don't, you know, maybe, hopefully there can be some changes and we can shake some people loose and things change by 2024. But this is our reality right now. And I wanted to reflect it honestly.
Well, you ask her why she's so angry. She says, I just don't feel the need to drive around my Prius, drinking a coffee culotta with a coexist bumper sticker and checking the box like I've solved climate change. Me moving from plastic to paper straws is not actually moving this needle. The liberal culture of judgment of do as I say, not as I do. John Kerry flying places in private jets. That's why I was so drawn to Trump. And you say you were just dumbfounded behind this description of her, of her choice. I mean, obviously we get to make a choice in this country, but nonetheless, how she described why Trump was somehow better than anybody else.
I was like, this is crazy. I don't like paper straws either. You know, I love a chocolate shake.
Sure.
Okay, the paper straws I think are kind of silly. But voting for Donald Trump over it? I mean, this is madness. It's so hard to wrap your head around. That answer was the most stark example of something I heard time and time again. I called dozens of my former colleagues, the ones who I thought were the quote-unquote good ones, you know, the ones who I knew had a, you know, had a heart and were decent people. And I was like, why are you still going along with this? And to a person, they gave a different version of that Caroline answer. They do not like you NPR hosts. I'm sorry.
I get
like
it.
They're mad at the media.
Right.
They're mad at the Lincoln Project. They're mad that their kids have to look at these DEI packets in schools. Obviously, there's a racial subtext to some of this, but there also is just this personal animus towards liberals in their life. And that was something that I just missed when I was in politics. Like, for me, I felt like it was this, I was, you know, and that's why I wanted to represent both elements of this. I think there are people that are corrupted by the game and the sport of it, and they just get caught up in wanting to be involved in politics. But then there are other people that have got caught, that have actually started to believe the BS and really think that their fellow Americans are evil and want Donald Trump because he's a middle finger to them. And that has been the most dispiriting part of this, and I think the most important thing for us to try to break moving forward.
But has it not worked? I mean, not only did Trump become president, but I remember reading when Obama was president, something like 1,000 Republicans got elected to state legislatures across the country.
Yeah.
I mean, in many ways, perhaps it's a playbook that works with Americans.
It does.
Or enough Americans, right?
Right. And no, it definitely doesn't. So this is why there's no incentives for the Republican political class to change, you know, because they've been rewarded. I mean, this is the set, you know, this is why I'm in therapy, you know, because it's the old lesson that you learn when you're 5 years old. I've had to learn as an adult, which is like sometimes good things happen to bad people. They've been rewarded by inflaming this anger, and so there's no, they don't see any reason for themselves to change, despite the fact that we came to the precipice, you know, of January 6th, of losing our democracy, and we might again. If you just look at the candidates in 2022, you know, you talked about the wave that brought in a lot of Republicans in 2010.
Yeah.
These candidates that are up in 2022 make the 2010 Republican candidates look like George H.W. Bush by comparison. I mean, it is madness out there. The man running for governor of Pennsylvania is a Christian nationalist who believes the election was stolen. And we could go, we already talked about Herschel Walker. The candidates that are up in 2022 are very scary, and they are not tacking back away from Trump. If anything, you know, they're learning from Trump and radicalizing more. And yet it's still, you know, the people who claim to know better continue to go along with it. And this is why the book is dispiriting, and it's maybe not a beet treat unless you're looking for some dispiriting. You can purchase it and save it for, you know, winter.
Well, you don't need to be defensive about your book, Tim Miller. But what
No, I'm not defensive. I'm just saying that's the reality that we're in, yeah.
What do you think the Democrats can learn from Donald Trump?
I wouldn't want to say learn. Look, I think that there's balance in all things, right? And I worry that the Democrats, you know, that some people might take from this book, okay, we've got to be pure and earnest, and we shouldn't participate in the political game at all. We should be above that. And that's not what the book is arguing. Like, what it's arguing is that we need to have integrity. We need to know what our red lines are. And we need to be honest with ourselves when we're working for somebody that passes a red line. I'm worried that the Democrats, that the pendulums has swung too far the opposite direction, and that people working in Democratic politics are not willing to be, you know, again, within integrity, cutthroat, mm-hmm. you know, to do what is necessary to win races, you know, not by lying and not by, you know, whatever, working for, you know, a mirror sociopath, not that I think one exists, but instead to aggressively prosecute a case against Republicans that is smart, you know, that is not based on their feelings or what they hope would be the best thing to campaign on, but what actually is going to convince the most voters. And Donald Trump was ruthless in this regard. You know, he was like a human poll. He would speak to the crowd and whatever their cheers were, he would change his message to match their cheers. Again, I'm not saying that anyone should be that cynical, but there's something to be said for, you know, understanding that the threat is great and that Democrats need to do, you know, what they can in order to combat it. And there are signs that's not happening.
Well, we're almost having a break here. Are you saying that Democrats spend too much time criticizing each other?
I think that's one part of it. I think another part is, you know, there are conversations that are meant for NPR and meant for the college campuses that aren't that popular and aren't meant for campaigns. And I hear Democratic candidates' rhetoric sometimes, and I'm like, you're playing into the Republicans' fear-mongering, right? You're only giving them ammo. And so I do worry that sometimes the Democrats' rhetoric, you know, look at just really quick, immigration, for example. The DREAM Act is an 80% issue. Decriminalizing the border is a 10% issue. Like, let's talk about the DREAM Act, right? Like, you could go over on case after case. Like, let's talk about areas where Republicans are out of step with voters and focus on that rather than talk about the thing that you think is the perfect thing, but that might turn off voters.
That's Tim Miller, our guest today on Radio Times. Again, he's got a brand new book. It's titled Why We Did It, A Travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell. He's currently a political analyst and journalist at The Bulwark and spent a number of years as a Republican operative. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing, talking with Tim Miller about his new book, and it's titled Why We Did It. Tim, let me read a bunch of comments here. Patty asks, how will knowing why many Republicans did what they did help repair the damage that they have done? And your book is a lot about the why and the how, and I guess the wherefore as well, but as a kind of autopsy, which I think it is. How is that helpful?
Well, I think that if we're going to ask, and unfortunately, as we come up to 2024, you know, I think that people are going to face this choice again. We have to reflect on, like, what are the reasons why people go along with bad things. And obviously this has been written about others, it's been written historically, this has been written about the banality of evil, you know, but I think that this window is hopefully helpful in figuring out how we can nudge some people away from it. And if you look at Cassidy Hutchison, who just testified, you know, this is someone that stayed with Trump all the way to the final day.
That's right.
You know, we're going to need people like that to move away from him in order to defeat him again, if he's to run again. One, maybe the most uplifting, but though obviously it's very mixed, character in the book is Alyssa Farah. She went all the way to being Donald Trump's communications director. She knew he was terrible. She didn't even vote for him. But she took this job out of a combination of feeling like he needed good people in there and ambition. And she has this crisis of conscience and after the election. And I spent a lot of time with her because at first I thought maybe it was for show to help save her career. But it really wasn't. I mean, she was crying and she was really trying to help deal with this. She had an emotional breakdown. And basically what it came down to for her was, you know, she saw that she was naive. Like, she thought that, you know, she could nudge things in the right direction and realized that she couldn't. And so instead, she started to think about, what are my kids going to think about me? Yeah. Like how am I going to be looked at by people in my life that I love, by my in-laws? I need to step out and do the right thing. Hopefully, maybe by reading this book and by revealing just, you know, as you said, the cynicism, but you know, how kind of ridiculous some of these justifications are, or how things that might sound good in your head don't really look good on a piece of paper that other people are reading. You know, hopefully, you know, this can help break some of these folks free, because I do think that there's this tendency to want to say they're all evil, they're sociopaths, they're irredeemable. And so there's no worth even caring about them. But that's not a path back to, you know, resolution, to a country that can work again. You know, that's just, you know, going down in an inevitable road, you know, that will lead us to another Trump term, or to someone like him.
John asks, he says, isn't your mea culpa quite late in the game? And this book is a mea culpa in many ways. Yeah. I don't. Why did it take so long? And you even say, you know, that you stayed longer than you should have. I think we understand a little bit sort of what kept you there, but what does your mea culpa feel like? And does it feel late in the game?
Yeah, of course. I mean, if I didn't have guilt over what I did, I wouldn't have had to write a book about it. I understand that people might think that it seems late. I think it's in the eye of the beholder. I guess because it's one thing we haven't talked about, so some listeners might not know. It is worth mentioning. I worked for a PAC that tried to stop Trump in the primary in 2016, after Jeb lost. That's what I did immediately. I worked for a PAC that tried to stop Trump. After Trump won the primary, every single person that worked for that PAC except for me and one other person then went to support Trump in the general election.
Wow.
When I stuck with Hillary, that just shows you the cynicism. Our PAC was called Our Principles PAC. Everyone that worked for Our Principles PAC except for me and this one other woman, Katie Packer Beeson, went on to work for Trump after calling it Our Principles PAC. So, and that just tells you a lot of, that's a veepish insight into the state of our politics. But, you know, so I did my part. I ran Republican voters against Trump in 2020, and you know, have written about all this. But in spite of all that, in spite of trying to stop him twice, three times, really, if you count the primary, after he lost, it still felt as if, you know, that I hadn't fully explained myself and haven't fully atoned what I did to kind of... create a path for him. And so that's what I wrote about in this book. So I, you know, some people might think, okay, too late. That's, you know, I'm not interested. I understand that. But I think that, again, in order to draft other people into the cause, it's important to kind of understand, you know, this process. And I'm also just really quick hopeful that there are some parallels for other people. There are people in other industries and other lives that they can learn from my experience. Maybe there are people listening who are like, I'm in a job right now, or I'm in an organization that makes me feel a little icky. I'm justifying it because of these other reasons. You know, maybe there are some life lessons that can be applicable broadly.
I want to pick up on something you referenced earlier, and Trump is making some noises about running again. I always hate to talk about an election 2 years ahead, you know, 2 years ahead of the action, so to speak. But do you anticipate a Trump-Biden rematch?
We're a long way away.
I
think that it's certainly possible. I think it's certainly possible. And Trump, look, if we know anything about Trump, this is a person that has a black hole inside of him that needs to be filled with attention and cheers and love and, you know, having his name on buildings. The idea that he is just going to step aside and let someone else, like Ron DeSantis or whoever, take all of the applause, I just find that hard to imagine. Maybe. Who knows? And then there are legal, I think, some benefits to being a candidate. People, it might be less likely that he's prosecuted if he's a candidate for office. Obviously, if you're in office, way less likely. So if I had to bet, I would. I think that there's a chance that he won't. But, you know, this Trumpism, I think, has infected the party and is not going away, regardless of what he does.
I'm looking at a New York Times Siena College poll came out today. This is all respondents, obviously, looking at Republicans. Donald Trump, 49%. Ron DeSantis, 25%. And then Ted Cruz, Mike Pence, Nikki Haley, and Mike Pompeo, all in the single digits. So clearly, he still has a following.
The Times headline in the story, I read this morning as well, was, half of the Republicans are ready to move on from Trump.
I saw that.
And I was like, that's a pretty optimistic headline. Only half of the party wants the big bad wolf to take over again. And the other half is okay with it. So, 49% is he never got 49% in 2016.
Yeah.
When he won the primary back then, when I was working against him, he was in the low to mid 40s most of the time. So 49% is clearly enough to win again, which is alarming. I don't think it's inevitable. I think conceivably somebody could beat him, but he's a clear front runner if he chooses to run.
Well, and he clearly saw, when you look at Donald Trump before his political aspirations, I mean, he sounded like a liberal Democrat in many ways, with some obvious exceptions. But there was something about the GOP where he saw that he could play his game of politics. What do you think he saw?
I think we are what he said that we were. For all of Donald Trump's flaws, I think the thing that he saw correctly was that the Republican establishment class was weak, was malleable, and was out of step with what the voters wanted. He went in and ran a primary that said, I don't think that these voters want trickle-down economics and true conservatism. I think they want someone that is going to be mean to the people that they hate and be very hard on immigrants and be very hard on the left and the media and, college, Ivy League elites, whatever. And these other Republican elites, think that they want these policies that the voters actually don't want. I don't know that Trump, saw that as like a political science thing. He just instinctively felt that, and he was correct about it.
Let me read some more comments. One from Jim. He just says, I would like to know if there are mentors in the Republican Party who teach people like Tim how to do this kind of dirty work. Was there a mentor that you had, Tim, or was this something that came to you naturally?
Yeah, no, every mentor I had is still in the game. It's like depressing. It's pretty dispiriting to have, like I said, again, these people, everyone has good and bad in them, right? A light side and a shadow side. And so there were people that were my mentors that taught me about politics who I thought, had good intentions. And to a person, they all stuck around with Trump. I wrote about some of them, including Reince Priebus, chairman of the Republican Party, who I worked for. But as far as teaching the game of politics, the RNC, the Republican National Committee, literally has a campaign school. And at this campaign school, the guy that taught me, the how to play the game of politics, said the best thing that you can do in politics is be someone who gets it. And gets it means you're not worried about the wonkery and the policies. Like, all you get that this is all about winning and losing and beating the other guy. And the best thing you can do is get it. He said that at an RNC college. Absolutely. We were schooled in this. But I do want to say, and again, I don't want to create an equivalence, but I did a politics with, I did a podcast with James Carville the other day.
Oh, you did?
And Carville said about this book, he's like, I think that the thing that you did the best, he said, because, you're out of it, was give the most vivid description of just the rush of the game of politics that does cross partisan lines. And he said that there were some elements, I think, that are very different about the Democratic base and party that have created antibodies that protect them from something like Trump. But there were some elements that he said really resonated and was true about Democratic campaign life. You do get caught up in this. He said it's like the napalm, from war.
Wow.
I can't do the Carvillisms.
Yeah. Sounds very Carville.
I do think that there is an element of this that crosses, that is just part of the culture broadly.
Gwen, thank you for telling your story. A comment from Harry. This is a long history that began a generation ago. It's not new. Why is the GOP keep dragging along the right-wing extreme? What do you think about that?
It's the opposite. The right-wing extreme is dragging along the GOP. I mean, I look at it as like two snowballs on a hill. If you go back to George H.W. Bush and Pat Buchanan, you know, the party was more, had more of these college educated, you know, kind of more moderate voters, and it was the bigger ball. But the Pat Buchanan smaller snowball was higher up the hill and was rolling and gained more momentum and ended up outpacing it. And so, like, now the party is controlled by the extremes, and, you know, the more moderate, you know, old school Chamber of Commerce side of Republicans, a lot of them have left the party, and the ones that are remaining, you know, are now the junior partners.
Well, and it seems that when people get fed a steady diet of lies, that leads naturally to conspiracy theories. I was watching a documentary last night about Trump, the rise of Trump, by a British documentarian whose name I totally forget. But nonetheless, he had a lot of interviews with Trump supporters, very sincere in their belief, talking about Joe Biden as a terrorist, for instance. And, it, you know, again, the word dispiriting, I guess, of the hour. But nonetheless, this connection between conspiracy theories and lies.
Yes. You know, and here's the other thing that I wrote about. Again, self-policing in an environment like this doesn't really work, right? Like, you know, if you say, well, I'm going to just, you know, give them hyperbole or comforting lies. Well, in a conservative media environment, there can always be someone that goes the next step. You know, I had this hilarious conversation for the book, Darkly Hilarious, with someone at Breitbart. And I was interviewing them about January 6th and Stop the Steal. And he said, well, you'll notice that at Breitbart, you know, we never went along with the craziest things that the MyPillow guy was pushing. You know, like we never went that far with the lies. You know, he's like, it was the Newsmaxes that were really irresponsible. And for me, I was like, oh my goodness, this is what, you know, we used to say about Breitbart. You know, it was like we would give, you know, a certain, go a certain level, and then Breitbart would push the envelope further. And now Breitbart is saying, oh no, the envelope is being pushed even further by Gateway Pundit and by Newsmax and by, you know, all these social media feeds that many of your listeners probably aren't even familiar with. And so, you know, you can always get one-upped in this game of lies and conspiracies. And when voters, you know, want, you know, get conditioned to being told what they want to hear over and over again, they're obviously going to gravitate to, you know, the most outlandish and the most extreme. Not every voter, but there will always be a group of voters that will.
But are you saying that the extremists, and you know, these are a minority of people, but they're outspoken and they're passionate about their beliefs, that they're really driving our political system?
I mean, I think that it's undeniable. I mean, so there's certain areas in non, you know, hot button issues in policy where there are still, I think, policy wonks in Washington that are kind of doing things outside of the spotlight. But anything that gets, any issue, any culture war issue that has been caught up by conservative media, you can just watch all of the candidates move to the extreme. And you know, we've seen this on the election conspiracies. There will be more election conspiracists in the next Republican caucus in the House and Senate than there were in 2020. So it's not as if January 6th caused people to walk back from the brink of that conspiracy. No. The people who voted to impeach Trump or voted to investigate the lies, they're being thrust out of the Republican Party and replaced by people who are pretending that they thought that the election was stolen. So I just think that's a prime example of who's in the driver's seat here.
We have a minute before we have to end our conversation talking about January 6th. So how do you think the committee is doing then, in spite of all that you just said?
I think that almost every person they've had testify has been a Republican. I think that Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger have been courageous and done a marvelous job. I think if you're expecting the goal is everyone who watches Fox to have the scales fall from their eyes, well, then the committee's not going to do that. But if they've done a good job of laying this out for history, laying this out for the gettable Republican voters and presenting a case that with sources that they might find credible, I think they have done a really nice job with that. And I thought that Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony in particular was remarkable. And I was just unbelievably proud of her for having the courage to do it.
Well, we have to leave it there. Tim Miller, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And the book is called Why We Did It, subtitled A Travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell. And Tim Miller is now political analyst and journalist at The Bulwark. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. And you can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. My thanks to Tracy Matisak for filling in for me last week. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you for joining us.